from the festive studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. It's time for another well-potted hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Interested in handing out holiday gifts that you can claim a hand in the growing? On today's show, we'll reveal how you can impress your friends with rosemary trees. Amaryllis about to bloom and the promise of tulips and crocus to come. The part you'll play is in the potting. Plus, Clemson researchers fight back against evil squirrels by giving the terrible tree rats pink bellies. And, of course, lots of your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and nattering nabobs of negativity. So don't dare diddle with that dial. It's all coming up like you supplying great holiday gifts that almost qualify as homegrown because you release the restricted roots of a really restrained rosemary right after this. Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. We have a jam-packed show for you cats and kittens this time out. When we get to the question of the week, it's actually three tips about holiday plants, rosemary, amaryllis, and spring bulbs that you can use as holiday gifts. We're also going to have an excellent interview about researchers finally taking the point and doing something about the squirrel problem. Wait till you hear what they're doing to the terrible tree rats at Clemson University. It'll bring a smile to the face of every gardener. But that's a lot to get done. We better go right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, John. How are you, sir?
I'm very well.
And where is John well?
In Downingtown, Pennsylvania.
Very good. What can we do you for?
I have in my backyard a small stand of winterberry holly.
Okay.
I have one male and three female, and they're beautiful. They're full of red berries. But from what I've learned from you, I don't prune them this time of year. This time of year is when I want to cut the red berries off and put them in my house and make my Christmas decorations.
That's correct.
And I also understand from you that pruning properly will cause the plant to maybe even grow more berries next year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to have the best of both worlds. I want to go out now and prune some berries in such a way that I will not harm the plant and maybe even make it better next year.
If we lived in the best of both worlds, trees would be more considerate, John. They would drop their leaves in the spring so that we could rake them up as the weather got warm, and then they would turn into compost rapidly. So your decision here is something every gardener faces who has evergreens and who has bushes that bear ornamental berries. We want to cut some of this material to make garlands and wreaths and greens. Why else do we have it? Why should we have to go buy that stuff from other people? We got it in the front yard, but we don't want to harm the plants. So I will acknowledge that you are absolutely correct, that I yell at people still for pruning at this time of year. Do I ever go out and harvest some greens and some holly branches and some pyracantha for my own holiday decorations? Of course I do. The honest answer is to delay the work as long as you can. Believe it or not, there is a lot of difference between, say, December 1st and December 7th. Just that little bit of delay. We rush the holiday season too much anyway. So the longer you can delay, especially the colder the weather as we're going into that, the better. But you're absolutely right. You can lean into this. We should certainly be using some of our own homegrown plants to make our holiday decorations. I try to hold off until December 15th for many reasons. First, I don't want to harm the plants. Second, I'm tired of Christmas beginning the day after Halloween. Hello. And also, if you rush it too much, especially these homegrown decorations, if we've been going through a dry spell like we kind of have, they can dry out pretty rapidly. So you want them to look their best that week between Christmas and New Year's. But what you want to do when you go out and harvest these holly branches is you want to harvest entire branches as much as possible. But yes, I'll be going out and I'll be harvesting some holly branches. I just like to wait as deep into December as I can. But luckily, hollies in general are very tough plants and can really survive pruning, even at bad times of year, more than others. And your winter berries are really sensational. Really, the only thing I really urge you to do is make sure you leave some for the birds, because you see how popular those berries are with your local birds, right?
Yeah, well, that's the problem with leaving it later is if I leave it too long, there'll be none left.
Are they really whacking away at it?
Not yet. It seems that they'll stay there for a while, and all of a sudden, one day, they're gone.
You know what you can do to prevent that, or at least delay it? Maybe put out some suet feeders now and distract the birds. I think if you're smart, you take entire branches, you wait as long as you can, you're not going to do any harm to the plant whatsoever. And yes, some pruning is really going to stimulate next year's flowering and next year's berry production. Although with you having the male in the same yard as the three females, it's your game to lose. I can't imagine that those females aren't loaded with berries every year.
Yeah, it's pretty effortless.
Yeah, well, that's the smart money. You don't depend on somebody else to have a male in the neighborhood. You put one out there yourself, and then you'll have more berries than you can use.
Okay.
All right, John?
Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, sir.
Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Jack. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well today. And you?
I am doing just fine. Thank you. Where is Jack doing well?
Jack is in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
What can we do for Jack?
Mike, since I've been listening to you, I have learned the error of my ways in having typical wood product mulch around my typical suburban single-family home in this area.
Good, good.
So I have allowed the mulch that was down there to disappear, fighting with the weeds in the meantime. And recently I made a trip to the south to the Atlanta area and saw something that is referred to as pine straw
and
mulch.
And you saw it everywhere, didn't you?
I did.
It is amazing.
But I don't see it up here in the north at all.
You can find it. You can find it. You may have to travel a little bit south, but it is phenomenal. As much as people here in the Northeast are totally infatuated with this trash wood mulch, which, by the way, after the hurricane and all the destruction down the shore,
right,
you have to be triply careful not to buy any wood mulch, because there's going to be a lot of pressure treated wood, you know, all the boardwalks that were destroyed down the shore, all the pilings. That stuff gets ground up along with the cheap pallets from China, spray painted some god awful color, and sold as triple premium shredded bark mulch.
Other than the availability of pine straw mulch in this area, the two other questions that I had or concerns were, it's so light, does it get wind blown and blown outside the areas that I would want it? And secondly, since the other thing that I did this year for the first time is become a backyard beekeeper, I know that I use white pine needles as fuel for the smoker to calm the bees, so I know it's quite flammable.
The big concerns are with regular wood mulch and with rubber mulch. This terrible rubber mulch, these recycled old tires, that stuff goes up like nothing in the summertime. You look at it, you try to imitate George Reeves' heat vision on the old Superman show, and it goes up. Wood mulch, because of the trashiness, because of the freshness, it actually suffers internal combustion and bursts into flame spontaneously. You don't have that problem with shredded leaves, which are the most abundant mulch in our area. I'm sure you still have lots of deciduous leaves around your property. go out and get a leaf blower that has a reverse setting, collect the shredded leaves. It shreds them as you go through the machine.
Right.
Collect those in the bag, empty the bag out where you need mulch, and you're done. And it doesn't blow away. Neither does pine straw mulch. And I will tell you that if you go as far south as Baltimore, you will start seeing it in large amounts at garden centers. A little closer to home, you may find a similar mulch called pine fines, F-I-N-E-S.
Okay.
My guess is that when they pile up lots of pine straw and it sits for a while, these fines are like rock quarry fines. It's the stuff at the bottom. So it's partially composted, but it still has that kind of look and feel of smaller particles of pine straw mulch. And I actually brought a bag of that home from Annapolis this past summer, and it seemed to have all the good qualities of every mulch combined. But again, you can use yard waste compost as mulch, even though it's counterintuitive. It prevents weeds just as well as shredded wood mulch.
Is that true if the majority of the yard waste is going to be lawn cutting rather than leaves?
No. You got to be very careful with grass clippings, because if they're treated with herbicides, the mulch can be deadly to other plants.
Right.
And one way to get around that, just shred up a lot of fall leaves. You're keeping your carbon footprint low. You're keeping the material on your landscape. And earthworms will colonize the soil underneath those shredded leaves, underneath that leaf litter. And they'll feed your plants for free all season. You won't need to add any plant food.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much.
All right. Very good question. Thank you.
Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners with newly planted trees that the tender young bark of those trees can be highly tasty to mice, voles, rabbits, deer, evil squirrels, and other vermin. That's why no tree less than 3 years old should be sent into the winter without guards protecting its tasty trunk. But don't go wrapping chicken wire loosely around your peaches, pears, and persimmons just yet, because we'll be right back with the story of the squirrel stoppers at Clemson University and three holiday gifts you can claim to be homegrown and even more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, rosemary Christmas trees, amaryllis, and spring bulbs. We'll tell you how to personalize these things, make them your own, and give them as holiday gifts. We'll also have lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time for an interview I've been looking forward to tremendously. Finally, an ally in the fight against evil squirrels. Greg Yarrow, chair of Clemson University's Division of Natural Resources. Greg, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the work you're doing. As a little background here, your story came to our attention from many sources because we have a giant army of Avengers trying to protect us from the terrible tree rat menace that you folks at Clemson University have come up with a great potential solution for. And specifically, you are attempting birth control on squirrels. Is that correct?
That's correct. It sure is.
But one thing in the story I read is that either you or the university attribute $1 million in horticultural damage to these tree-swinging servants of Satan.
And it's all primarily due to their gnawing ability and chewing. They have damaged over 100 mature trees on campus by gnawing the limbs and the main trunks.
In Clemson, the damage has mostly been to mature trees.
It's mature trees is probably the highlight, but we're seeing a damage to smaller shrubs, and even in our botanical gardens, they have a habit of chewing all our plastic tags that we use to identify our trees and plants, and their teeth continually grow. So part of this, we think, is the effort to keep their teeth from growing too much, and then the other part of it is, we think, in high densities where you have a lot of squirrels, that the males actually become more territorial, and the way they mark their territory is they will chew on a certain area and mark that area. So a combination of this, though, isn't good when you got so many squirrels in an area. Part of the study we had in the first phase of the project is watching the behavior of these squirrels, and some of our students, in terms of looking at what they do during the day, noticed that they would actually had the ability to jump up and down on a faucet handle to turn on water and would actually drink the water and then run off. They're very adaptable, and that gives rise to frustrations with people that are trying to grow a garden or provide bird feeders for you know, a variety of birds, where squirrels also can get in those feeders.
And you're actually kind of using those feeders to get at the squirrels, because you've come up with a method of not only lacing birdseed with squirrel birth control, but you've come up apparently with a bird feeder, so to speak, that birds can't get at, but squirrels can?
Let me stress first that this is extremely experimental, but there are two methods to deliver contraceptives, and the first method that we used, the first phase of our project, was actually catching the squirrels and injecting the squirrels with amnio contraceptive that shut down reproduction, and it was shown to be effective, but the cost of catching squirrels and implementing the vaccine was too prohibitive. So we switched to a treated bait. In order to deliver it, you have to make sure that the bait that's treated is specific for gray squirrels. The squirrels are able to get into these hoppers and feed, and other animals cannot get into the hoppers, so it makes it very target-specific for gray squirrels.
And, Greg, do they have to eat the contraceptive-laced seed on a regular basis? How often do they need to eat this seed? How long do the effects work?
The first year of the project was actually trying to determine when these guys breed. So we were catching squirrels and drawing blood and looking at hormonal levels. So we pinpointed down when they breed. And the key is to deliver this oral contraceptive with bait prior to breeding season. So you need at least a month before breeding season to be able to deliver it and for it to be effective. We have the bait has a biomarker in it. It's actually pink. And so we're able to see those squirrels that have been treated. Their underbellies actually turn pink. So we have these pink squirrels on campus that have been eating the bait. They're very acclimated to come into these hoppers. They have no problem in terms of getting the bait and feeding. So that's the method we're using to deliver it. And early results show that those squirrels that have consumed the bait a month prior to breeding, the metrics we're using to evaluate how effective it is are showing a positive response.
Now, Greg, obviously you've created a hopper, so to speak, that squirrels can only get into, but I'm presuming male and female squirrels are both going in.
That's correct.
But is the contraceptive only affecting one of them?
It primarily affects the males in this case. It can have a limited effect on females, and that's something we're looking at now. We're seeing more effect on males. But preliminary information and information that we can provide might provide an impetus for this to be looked at as a serious management tool.
Oh, Greg, you realize that should this ever become legal and go on sale, the lines of gardeners would stretch 100 times further than the biggest crush that ever occurred when a new iPhone or an iPad was released.
Okay, well, I can see what you're saying. There's still regulation in terms of state wildlife agencies and their states being able to approve this type of approach. And so, from a regulatory standpoint, yeah, you'd have to cross those go through those hoops too. But yeah, I see where you're visioning. Possibly.
You give us hope, man. That's all we can ask for now. All right, Greg Yarrow, chair of Clemson University's Division of Natural Resources. He joined us today from Clemson University in South Carolina. Greg, keep up the good work, and I don't want to hear about pink bellies disappearing on Clemson's campus.
Surely not, and it's been a pleasure. Come visit us.
If you can show me pink bellies, I'm on my way right now.
Very good.
All right. Thank you, Greg.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Diane, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Diane. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Thanks. And where is Diane? Very well.
I'm in North Carolina, and just between Beaufort and Newport. I have a couple of hydrangea plants. One of them's a little bit wimpy, and the other one's doing great. And the wimpy one might be because my husband ran over it with a lawnmower last year.
That could do it.
But anyway, I'm wondering when you're supposed to prune it, because I heard that if you prune it at the wrong time, then you don't get flowers.
That's right, and your husband already pruned it with a lawnmower, which we do not, which we don't advocate. With some plants, the rules of pruning are very simple. Spring-blooming plants, like azaleas, rhododendrons, lilacs, you only prune those after they finish flowering. But years ago, we had a guy on the show who was acknowledged as the world's greatest hydrangea pruning expert, who immediately said, hydrangeas have never read these books. They've never read these instructions. They don't know how they're supposed to behave. So over time, he came up with a technique that I have adopted that is sheer genius, that makes sure you can't screw up. And that is you leave the plants alone, wait until they wake up in the spring, allow them to grow, and then, as you know, about mid-spring, they start forming their flower buds.
Yeah.
Once that happens, you continue your watchful waiting for about 2 weeks until you're sure that everything that's going to form a flower has formed a flower. And then you go in and you take out the branches that are non-flowering that you don't like. And the genius of this technique is this pruning will stimulate the following year's bloom, and especially on these hydrangeas like Endless Summer that have the ability to rebloom, to continually bloom. Pruning away these old stalks will bring up more flowers. By following this advice, you can't hurt the plant. You ensure that you can see virtually every flower, and you stimulate new growth and new blooms that could come out a little bit later in the season.
All right.
And more importantly, you don't make any mistakes, which is always good.
Yeah, right. Now, should they be fed with some kind of nutrient?
I have never fed my hydrangeas, and they seem very happy. The only thing I would ever give them would be a mulch of compost first thing in the spring when they break ground. Certainly no chemical fertilizer. Although, you know, with the basic hydrangeas, the ones that are either pink or blue, you can moderate that color if you want by adding not fertilizer, but something to acidify or alkaline the soil.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if you have hydrangeas that bloom pink and you toss down a whole bunch of peat moss, the pink flowers will change to blue, even if they're already out in pink. If you put a layer of peat moss behind the plants, but not in front of them, you'll get some blue flowers in the back and some red flowers up front.
And if
you only want pink flowers, you spread a little wood ash around. And if you experiment with this year after year, you'll find you can really play around. You can make a little dusting of wood ash here, a little bit of peat moss here, and then move it around, and you'll have plants that are not only pink and blue flowers on the same plant, but where the kind of pH adjusters meet, you'll have flowers, single flower heads that are a combination of the two colors.
Oh, gosh, that's really interesting.
So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, Diane.
Thank you very much.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. How are you?
I am doing well. Where is Chris Fine?
Sassonville, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
Not too far from you.
You're our butterfly caller, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. You had a pair of monarch butterflies hatch out of chrysalis in very late fall. When did this happen?
Yes, it was right around when Sandy was hitting. My son was looking out the window, and I landscape with milkweed, so I have it in my gardens and stuff. So he's looking out the window, and he's like, there's a monarch. And I was like, there's not a monarch out there. Sure enough, there was one sitting there. And
right. We'll remind people who have kind of forgotten or in different parts of the country or were in a coma that Sandy hit like right before Halloween. So we're
You're
talking
right.
late October.
Yes. Yeah. It was about October 29th. And that was our first one we saw. That first monarch didn't take off right away, and we decided to bring him in that evening because the temperatures are starting to fall. And we're still waiting for the storm to hit, mind you, and
right.
temperatures are above 60 the next day. I took that monarch out and flew south immediately. But when we went out to discover that monarch, there was another chrysalis there. So I was a little worried because the storm was coming. And the temperatures were falling, and we already had our first hard frost, which that's why I was really surprised to see a monarch anyhow. Right before the storm hit, I went out and I cut the branch that the chrysalis was on, and I brought it in so it wasn't wind damaged when it decided to come out. That one did come out during the storm.
Inside your house?
Inside the house. I put it over with the plants, and there it was just coming right out for us. I let the storm pass, and I was hoping that this one could fly south, too, but after that storm, our temperatures dropped, and apparently monarchs can't fly below 60 degrees.
When did the other monarchs go? When did they pass through Pennsylvania?
Normally, late September. We go to Ocean City, New Jersey in mid-September, and you can just sit there on the beach and count them as they go by, and they're all traveling south.
So these guys were like a month late.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And right before we went on that trip to Ocean City, New Jersey, we actually saw them as caterpillars. We were waiting all summer to get monarch caterpillars, and we weren't fortunate enough to get ones out there on our milkweed until that very last minute. I was like, well, they're kind of late, but I guess they know what they're doing. We ended up with that monarch in our house. We realized that it had to get nectar at that point, so I had to start hand feeding it. And we're looking at the weather, seeing when it's going to go above 60 degrees. I stepped out to take out some recyclables, and sure enough, there was another one that came out on his own during the storm. Now I have these two monarchs. I'm hand-feeding them. I'm waiting for it to get above 60, and I think it was about 12 days before it might go up to 60. And I was just thinking, this is not going to happen. I don't know if they're going to be able to make it. So we started talking about what we could do. First, we started thinking about driving. We could have a
road
trip.
What, you're going to drive them to Mexico?
You know, it opens up doors to opportunities of travel. My wife, she has a cousin in Texas, so we decided to work with her and ship them down. But before I did that, I did some research on how to ship them, because there's companies that do ship monarchs. On their website, it talks about how they ship them, so I mimic that as best as possible, and I packaged them up in a overnight, and I eagerly waited to hear how they fared on their travels. My wife's cousin, she sent us the video of them releasing them.
So I don't know if you're a hero or if you were conned that they just decided they didn't want to fly under their own power, so they just kept like, oh, look at us, oh, us poor butterflies, put us on an airplane, mister.
Well, it was fun. I did feel a sense of responsibility, and I do have a soft spot for butterflies, and I was happy to do it.
And you documented this, or you and the other family documented this, from the time you brought the butterflies inside to the time they were released in Texas.
That's correct. My wife has a blog. It's naturallyeducated.com. And she wrote it up on her blog, and she also has other little lesson plans in there about the butterflies.
Well, we are going to put up a link with this show to the website blog, and people who are interested in this story can see the visuals of the monarchs hitching the ride of all time. All right. Well, thank you, Chris. What an amazing story. And thank everybody else involved.
Thank you.
All right. You take care. And we'll put that link up on the website. People can follow the story and follow the butterflies.
Great.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind our listeners who intend to purchase a truly live Christmas tree, that's one that's bald and burlap with its roots still intact, to dig the planting hole now, before the soil freezes hard for the season. Now, make sure the area you choose isn't near overhead power lines and has enough room for the skirt of the tree to grow nice and wide. Oh, and as the public service spots always remind us, call before you dig to make sure you don't sever your neighbor's TV cable right before a Charlie Brown Christmas comes on. But don't go picking up that landline just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and three semi-homegrown gifts you can give out on the holidays. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, which this week is the tip of the week, and it's actually three tips. We're going to tell you how to put your personal touch on those little rosemary Christmas trees, amaryllis bulbs, and spring bulbs, and provide somewhat homegrown, at least you can claim homegrown, holiday gifts that people will really appreciate. That's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kayla, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello?
Hello, Kayla. How are you?
Hi, I'm well. How are you?
I'm okay. Now, Kayla, you are a student at the University of Delaware, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you're part of a story we've been following this past fall, I guess when school first started. Students broke out in a rash that many people are attributing to a very nasty cocktail of herbicides that the school was treating the lawn with. Tell us how you wound up writing about this and your involvement in it.
I was writing an assignment for a class, and I was looking at the university's drinking water and, I guess, where we get it from and then what we do to it to look at what kinds of things people downstream might have to deal with. And a professor kind of offhandly mentioned, hey, you might want to look into what the university does in terms of chemicals on the lawn. And I said, okay, that's a good idea. I started looking into it. I found out that there wasn't really much information available, and it was really difficult to find anything out. And then one of my friends, she mentioned to me that, you know, I was sitting on the green earlier today, and I broke out. I said, well, that's funny, because I just saw the guys out there spraying the day before. And since that happened, I've got about 28 stories now of kids who don't have grass allergies who have sat on the green and have broken out in hives.
When we talked to one of the professors there a couple weeks ago, all I could think back to was my college days where the lawns were such a respite from the classrooms where as soon as you were out of class on a nice day, you didn't just sit on the lawn. You rolled around on the lawn. You were thrilled to be outside.
Oh, exactly. I mean, people are out there, you know, on their stomachs reading books. People are playing frisbee, you know, football. But, yeah, I mean, it's really kind of a communal place. And so we thought as students who are paying to go here that we kind of had a right to know what kinds of things that they're putting down. And it turns out that we do have a right to know that, you know, we found a bunch of policies that say that material safety data sheets are readily available to anyone who, you know, students, employees who request them. But it's been 2.5 months now trying to get a full comprehensive schedule, and we still haven't been able to find anything out.
And you're coming at this from two different angles. First of all, this was an assignment for a class in that college. And do I understand you correctly that the administration of the college is preventing you from researching your assignment?
They're telling me, you know, they're telling me and the rest of the students who are working on this that everything's EPA approved, everything is safe. As a student, you know, I study environmental science and kind of trying to think about all the different factors that might play in, and the one that keeps coming back is the one that I have no information about that makes me suspicious. They're not being very forthcoming about it, and we want to know when they were applied and how much and what. And like I said, we're not really getting that information, unfortunately.
And as I mentioned to the professor we had on the air a couple of weeks ago, this is hugely ironic because the University of Delaware is known for its groundbreaking environmental research on so many fronts. They have been investigating invasive plants. You've got Doug Tallamy there, a great expert on native plants. I was under the impression that the U of D was all about green and sustainability.
is definitely ironic that with all of our resources, we haven't really made any strides in addressing this, but I think a lot of people are hopeful that maybe we'll make some progress soon. You know, I'm going to walk off the stage soon, and for the, you know, next wave of students that comes in, we're really hoping we're able to leave behind something that's a little better than how we found it.
We are going to keep following this story. We have been in touch with the administration. Maybe they'll be on the air next.
Oh, great.
But don't give up hope that you might still be able to graduate on a chemical-free lawn.
I would be really happy to be able to do that. That would be amazing.
All right. Well, you keep up the good work and keep hoping.
Thank you so much.
All right. You take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Edna, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Edna. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I am just fine, thank you. Where is Edna well?
I live in Yardley, Pennsylvania.
Okay, not too far from Philly. What can we do you for?
Well, I have a question about my crepe myrtle, which is, or was, beautiful. It's about 3 years old. It's in a sunny location, and it was absolutely gorgeous this summer and fall. And then I'm not sure if it was the hurricane or what it was, but I walked out the door one day, and every leaf on it was crinkled up, and I don't know what to do about it.
Now, you say you've had your crepe myrtle in the ground for 3 years.
Yes, at least 3 years, maybe three or four.
And do you ever prune it?
I've cut back on the edges a little bit, maybe once.
Oh, okay. And what time of year or when was that?
In late summer.
Okay. That would be the wrong thing to do. That wasn't recent, was it?
No, that was the previous year.
Okay. Don't do that again.
All right.
That's not the time to cut anything back, especially wasn't it fully in bloom at that point?
Yes, it was, although the branches I cut back were not actually blooming. But it was becoming so invasive.
This is the type that has the many multiple trunks.
Yes.
Yeah, and you're trying to cut the trunks back. Best time to do that is in the spring.
All right.
Now, has the plant been fed, mulched?
I'm afraid not.
Okay, no, those are both good answers, actually. Is it growing out of a lawn?
No, it's in a rather small circular area in front of my house. It's not on a lawn.
And it's just bare earth underneath it?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Huh. So a very naturalistic. And did you notice the crinkling of the leaves right after the hurricane?
You know, I don't remember exactly if it was like the day after, but I know it was after the hurricane occurred. And the thing is that it looked perfectly fine, and it was like an overnight thing. That's what puzzles me about it.
This reminds me very much of something called herbicide drift, when somebody will be out spraying Roundup on poison ivy or something like that, or they're spot treating weeds in a lawn, and they're doing it on a windy day, and the herbicide hits another plant. If the wind is correct and people are using one of these triple strength herbicides, it can travel quite a bit. It's almost like a bullet in a World War II movie. You never get to see the person who's spraying the spray that got to your tree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, does this mean, number one,
no, it doesn't mean anything yet, because we're past the period of photosynthesis. The tree is going to go to sleep for the winter.
Uh-huh.
Now, I will tell you that the milder winter we have, the better your chances the tree will recover completely. About how tall is the thing now?
Oh, it's 10 or 12 feet.
Okay. Here's what you're going to do. In the spring, we're going to wait to see new growth. Obviously, if you see no new growth, you're going to have to kind of remember eyeball it. You know, think back to previous years.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
By the time the tree would be out of dormancy and really lush. If you get normal new growth, I want you to arrange to have the tree pruned back by about a foot all around, every branch.
Okay.
That'll stimulate a lot of new growth. The tree will regrow to the same height. You could take off 2 feet and the tree would regrow to that height in a year. This is actually good for crepe myrtles to get a nice little haircut in the spring when they start to regrow. If you don't see any regrowth, I want you to put down a mulch of an inch of compost around the base of the plant.
Okay.
And then I want you to arrange to just have 6 inches taken off every branch. That's your best bet at shocking it back to life, so to speak. Right. If you do see the new growth, wait 2 weeks and cut everything back by a foot or 2 feet.
Okay, that would be great. I'd be very happy to do that, actually, because it's really gotten so large, larger than I'd like it to be.
And the compost feeding, it's probably due for that at this point.
Okay.
All right, Edna?
All right. Thank you very much, Mike.
All right. My pleasure. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, which this week is actually a tip instead of a question. 3 tips, in fact. Rosemary, amaryllis, and spring bulbs. 3 sort of homegrown holiday gifts. We'll begin with rosemary. Now, a sure sign of the approaching holidays is the appearance of those wonderful Christmas tree-shaped live rosemary plants in garden centers and supermarkets. They make great gifts and tabletop tannenbaums, but they have one problem. They are 100% dog-dirty, 6 times sideways root-bound, jammed into pots so small there's no room for any soil in there. So as soon as you get your little tree home, remove the wrappings and transplant it into a pot at least twice as big. Be sure to use potting soil, a soil-free mix, or compost to fill in the gaps, not your awful outdoor dirt. Then take your newly planted tree and set it in a few inches of water for an hour or so to allow the holes in the bottom of the pot to really saturate the soil and roots. Let it drain, and then place it in a bright area but away from heat vents and radiators. Repeat the same watering regimen once a week or whenever the pot feels light. To gift your tree, just rewrap the pot. Warning, warning, do not ignore this repotting advice. Rosemary trees that are moved into bigger pots usually thrive over the holidays and often survive to go outside in the spring. Rosemary trees left trapped in their too tight pots quickly look like Jack's little tree in A Nightmare Before Christmas. And once she's brown for good. We move on to amaryllis. Seeking an inexpensive yet distinctive holiday gift that your friends will be sure to appreciate and that will deceive them into thinking you have the ultimate green thumb? Buy a bunch of amaryllis bulbs and pot them up. You can buy the little kits that come complete with soil in a pot, or just get a bunch of big solid bulbs, some pots that are only a couple inches wider than the waist of the bulb, and a bag of premium potting soil. Put some soil in the bottom of each pot, position the bulb on the soil so that at least half the bulb will remain above the top of the pot, and then fill the pot with more soil. Do not bury your amaryllis-to-be. At least half of that bulb must be out in the open air for the plant to thrive. Sit the pots in a few inches of water for an hour or two, let them drain, and then just place them in a warm spot. 75 degrees Fahrenheit is ideal. In a few weeks, the flower stalks will appear. When they do, move the plants into bright light, water lightly, and turn them every couple of days so they get equal light on all sides. The entire process typically takes about 6 weeks from planting to flowers opening. So if you get right on it, your homegrown lovely should have big buds ready to impress by Christmas Day. And plants with just big buds travel much better than ones with open flowers. And finally, spring bulbs. Every fall, I receive boxes of spring bulbs from online and catalog suppliers. And this year, one of them invited me to pick my own order instead of receiving some new releases or bulbs representative of the latest garden trend or theme. But my landscape is already as full of bulbs, 25 years worth, as I am a soup. And I was inspired to try some forcing this year by my interview earlier this season with Art Walk about his book, Bulb Forcing for Beginners and the Seriously Smitten. So I ordered an assortment of crocus, tulips, grape hyacinth, and daffodils. In that case, specifically tete-a-tete, my favorite member of the narcissus family and a variety that's well known in forcing circles. Got a big bag of the lightest potting soil I could find. I lightened it up some more by mixing in a lot of perlite. That's a natural mined mineral that's popped in big ovens until it looks like little styrofoam balls. And gathered up some of my absolute nicest pots. Those would be the ones without big cracks in them. I filled the pots halfway with my soil-free mix. Placed the bulbs on top, really crowding them in tight. Touching side to side from the center to the edges, filled the pots the rest of the way up, set them in a few inches of water for a couple hours, let them drain, and then took them down to the beer fridge in the basement, which is mostly used for its freezer. That fridge is now set at 45 degrees Fahrenheit and filled with pots labeled with two important notations, the name of the bulb and the date that pot went into the big chill. Little bulbs like crocus can come out after 10 weeks of chilling. Big bulbs like tulips should chill for 14 weeks. Longer chills are better than shorter, and after chilling, the pots need to come out into a warm environment and bright light. Now, at this point in the season, your gifts won't be ready for the holidays, but you can wrap a photo of the pot with a note saying your homegrown gift will be delivered in the spring. Well, those sure were some interesting ideas for somewhat homegrown holiday gifts, now, wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over in detail and get some extra information that we didn't have time for on the air today. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to chill me in a pot if I don't get out of this studio. Hey, at least there might be a beer nearby. Any chance there's some hop devil down in that fridge? Ow! We really must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your child, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Like us on Facebook. Please put the actual subject of your email in the subject line of the email. Like us on Facebook. And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems just like yours in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and you guessed it, like us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Love Train Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Larry Roebling is our producer. Alexis Landis, who normally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM, continues her maternity leave. And that means Ari Landis is our cute baby. I was a very cute baby, says our social media director, Amanda McGrath. I think I was cute, says Ace production assistant, Brett Rader. I'm still cute, insists our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'm feeling like the punchline in an old Flip Wilson routine. So I'll just say that I'll see you next week. Yes, Virginia, there are native fruit trees. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the growing of persimmons and pawpaws, the famed banana of the North, plus your fabulous phone calls.